You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
All marshmallows, when squeezed, can reinflate eventually. Alexi Pappas knows not to take herself too seriously, at least most of the time. That intro quote, taken from an essay she wrote last month on enduring pain, is a glimpse into the creative world Pappas inhabits, one that includes filmmaker, poet, and professional distance runner. Having recently returned from Rio, where she participated in the 10,000-meter track and field race at the Olympics as part of Team Greece, Alexi achieved a new national record for Greece in the race, set a new personal best, and scored in the top half of the competitors as one of the fastest women in the world. As if that weren't enough, she also excels in the creative arts. Alexi cracks open the fascinating world of elite running for audiences through quirky, playful films, Twitter haikus, and thoughtful essays and interviews on being a champion of pain, a role model for young female athletes, and how to overcome fear and achieve your dreams. Tonight, we'll see a few clips from her series of Super 8 shorts, as well as from her feature film, Tracktown, that debuted at the LA Film Festival earlier this year. Alexi Pappas' work is authentic, from the heart, and spiced with a sense of humor I find endearing and honest. I first read about her through an interview in the New York Times, which also hosts her short film series called Speed Goggles that she co-produced with her partner, Jeremy Tasher. Alexi is also the co-founder of the Portland chapter of Film Fatales, a nationwide group of female directors. We've invited Alexi to the library to share her stories alongside another creative mind, Sharon Ann Lee. As a culture and trends analyst, Sharon studies the big ideas that shape our changing tastes, opinions, and values. She's been at the forefront of global trends and youth culture for over 15 years and is the founder of Culture Brain, a culture think tank and creative studio. And that's the same name where you can find her in the social media realm. Most recently, Sharon launched, in the role of co-host, a podcast about the life and philosophies of Bruce Lee. I can always count on Sharon to share her insights and intuition about new projects we're thinking about here at the library, and I value her creative sensibilities and generosity.
Well, I have a question for Alexi, for all of us. So do you feel like this kind of rarefied creature, like that nature documentary style of Super 8 that you did sometimes?
Those are my routines. That is, encapsulates many of my mornings in a stylized way. So we are creatures in a way, but also, like, I think these videos have a lot of truth in them. So that is how I got to Rio, I guess.
So I want to kind of ask you a question about the moment you fell in love with running. I mean, you are having a relationship with running, right? So before we get to talk about the Olympics, tell us about the moment that you just fell in love with running and knew, I just want to keep doing this.
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I think a lot of people pursue running or athletics for any number of reasons. And for me, it was more about the team environment that got me into running, which is counterintuitive because it's an individual sport. It seems like an individual sport. And for me, I fell in love with running when I found people I could enjoy it with. And that wasn't until college, actually, which was not my first time running, but it was my first time really finding a bond with people and being able to engage in this very social sport in a way that was fun, and in a way where the trade-offs to committing to our goals felt like a choice rather than a sacrifice. So it was like,
how is running a social sport? Because as a viewer, we just see you guys just, you know, intensely running or training. But talk to us about like how it's social.
It's social while you run, and sometimes, and that's actually a way that some coaches prescribe paces, is by saying like chit chat pace, or like this work, because you can't get as many chits as chats. And so it's social in that you're talking to people every day, but it's also social in that you meet a lot of people running. There are a lot of people who run, and in going into adulthood, it's a sport where I've been able to do it not just within the context of like my home field and my home team, but rather I can train in Mammoth Lakes for a while and meet some new athletes or role models, or you can go and train in another country, or you can be entirely alone. And so I think that adds an extra layer of social element that keeps it interesting.
And so feeling like you were more connected to people really got you to fall in love with running?
Yeah, the people thing is huge. And I'm sure anyone who does anything in a group can feel that, like, the energy around you is either hopefully a positive feedback loop, but when you're running a race in a marathon, if you will, which I've never done, there are thousands of people presumably around you, and there are people along the course, and that if you like people, then you'll like those painful experiences despite the pain.
Oh, okay. You have somebody to commiserate with.
Yeah, and someone who's like, yeah, you're doing it, or like someone who's doing it right next to you. There's an element of like amusement about it rather than this inward-looking sad thing, which pain can also be.
And so when did you decide, I want to train for Olympic trials? Like, when did that moment come to you?
I think it took finding someone who believed in me more than I believed in myself at the time to admit that that was a goal of mine. And I think like writing down your goal is almost scarier than the thought of not achieving it, because writing it down is like admitting that you want something that you might not get. Uh-huh. So I think for me that was later in college. So when I started running in New Hampshire at Dartmouth, I was like the worst on my team because I hadn't run in other soccer and student government, some boys, like whatever we were doing. And in college, I wanted to run, and I found that team that I mentioned, mm-hmm. but I wasn't athletically fit enough to contribute to the team score yet. And so when I finally like slowly worked my way to getting that team point and then showing the potential, my coach at the time, who was an Olympian, said, I believe in you. Like, you can do this if you take yourself seriously enough. And I think sometimes it does take someone who gives you permission to believe in yourself for you to then take the next step and believe in yourself.
And did you ever ask him what was it that he saw in you that made him believe in you?
No, I was like, you just believe me? Okay. Like, he just expressed that he had seen, there's a physical element, you know, like if you're a runner if you're meant to run, I think I'm meant to run. I think my body is meant to run. And I think it was the mental development that he needed me to see more. Because anyone can train and improve. And that's another thing I love about running. But I think the mental piece was something that he was really stressed. And it wasn't something that I was aware of. That like becoming a champion or becoming an Olympian is a mental development too.
So you see runners and athletes who have the physical capabilities and prowess, but they haven't kind of conquered the mental part, and so then, you know, they're just not as strong competitors?
Yeah, I think there are limits. I think there are limits to athletes who, in particular events, it's more obvious than others. Like, I love the 10,000, which is the longest event on the track. It's 25 laps. And I love it because it's as much mental as it is physical, where you're running and you can tell that that girls are freaking out, and like and being calm really helps because it's predicting how you're going to feel in mile 6 at mile 2 is very hard. You know, like, pain is coming, but to be able to be calm as the thing unravels is so is a maturity thing. And so I think I found the event older. I ran my first 10,000 about a year ago, a year and a half ago, and I don't think I was ready before that to do it. And so when you asked about the mental piece, I think that it is a big thing. Or it's a tool. It's not like it can hold you back, but mostly it can propel you forward, you know?
So Alexi just competed in the Rio Olympics in a 10,000 meter. What was it like for you just being there? We were just talking about the biggest kind of, you know, food commissary that she's ever seen before. It's like the size of a football field. Like, just all these interesting experiences of being with kind of the world's elite athletes. Tell us a couple stories about just, you were a great observer being there, right?
I was a great observer. So we lived in the village, which was about a mile and a half around, and everything in there, you had everything you needed as an athlete in there, and most everyone stayed there. So thousands of athletes of all sports, of all ages, all put in these rooms and buildings that are a little bit too small for them. And so that means that a lot of them, the buildings are bursting at the seams, so most athletes ventured out and went to the dining halls and hung out in the common spaces. And so my experience there was very much filled with eye candy of these other athletes. And one of the things I liked the most is that we were required to wear uniforms all the time for our specific country. And so I run for Greece. I'm a Greek-American dual citizen. And this is actually the jacket that I wore every day that was given to me. And what I loved was seeing all these other athletes from other countries and knowing, okay, like, it's so rare to, you could be in a diverse space and not know where everyone is from, but here you knew because it said on their back, Malaysia, China, Ethiopia, and you knew. And then you could go to the dining hall alone, as I did, this giant football field of a place, and sit alone. But meet people so easily because so many athletes are there relatively alone. And so I felt like my experience was different than maybe someone who was on a team sport where maybe you stick with your team. I felt like I met a lot of people and used that energy of the Olympics is a special place and a special time to fuel me in my race. And that was the biggest thing was, sometimes I treat a race like it's any other race, but in this case, I was like, this is a special race, and that really helped me overcome some of the challenges during the race.
And how was the race for you? What was the experience of racing in the Olympics like for you?
It was fun. I got lapped, too, was the thing. It was a it was a world record-breaking race, so I was aware that things would unfold in a crazy way from the gun, from when it started. And that mental piece was really important because my goal was to get the most out of my mind and my body on that day. Mm-hmm. And I knew that that meant something different for me than the girl who did break the world record. And it was important to, like, be calm about that and also have integrity with my own running where at any given moment, making sure that I was trying my best, it's different than everyone else's best, and being okay with that. And it helped. And it felt like unlike any other race I've run, where I felt more confident, in comfortable and happy with what I was doing than I've ever felt before.
Oh, why do you think that?
Well, before races, I try to like do a lot of visualization, and oftentimes it involves like a race plan or a competitor that I know that I want to beat, and I visualize like overcoming hard moments that I anticipate will come. But for this race, I was told by an old coach that I should try to hyper-focus, which I'd never heard before. And I grappled with it a lot before the race. Like, what do you mean? And what he explained was that there should be nothing else in the world. Like, at the Olympics, like, you should give it its time. And he was right. Like, it's important for any race, but particularly this one, to really be okay with, like, being completely with myself and in this place. And I think that the difference between this race and other races was that I was most in that place of almost like a meditative place with yourself, which I'm sure writers can experience, or any, like, chefs. I'm sure anyone can get to that place. And I think I got the closest to that place that I've ever been.
For those of you who don't know, also, Alexia is not just an Olympic runner, but she is a multi-talented creative person. She's a poet, she's a filmmaker, and I have a few of your poems here, and one of them is titled Before Olympics 2016. And if you could just read it and then just tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write it.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's just called Before. Oh, yeah, Before. And then Olympics 2016. That's the, yeah. Okay. I face the thing before I do the thing. So when I imagine the thing, I know what color its eyes, where it is ticklish, what makes it cry, the spots it is shy, the cracks where bravery hides, so that when I need it, I can keep it, pull it out from inside. And this is about that visualization process of some races. You can know, like, there's a hill or there's like a point where I always hurt, and you can imagine yourself, literally imagine like an Alexi or a Sharon pushing through a moment that you anticipate will be hard. Mm. And I think with this poem, also envisioning parts where you're succeeding and like imagining that the best can happen, so that you almost like have decided ahead of time that it's going to go well. So I think it's that whole mind, the mind over body thing that they talk about with sports sometimes.
So when did you start writing poetry, and then how is poetry integrated into your running practice? Like, is it part of the whole?
I think I started writing poetry before I was a very competitive runner. Mm-hmm. Earlier in college, found that poetry was had these like limitations on it of, you know, an economy of words and being very thoughtful with each word that I loved. And I think that evolved side by side with the running, where in running there are similar limitations. You want to be efficient. Maybe you have to stay within certain boundaries, or there are certain laps, but within those boundaries, there's a lot of freedom. And so I think the idea that there's a lot of freedom within boundaries in those two worlds is fun for me to think about. But I think it's also just on a practical level and great to have something besides athletics in my life, so that I end practice at some point and go away from the sport and mm-hmm. just let it be every day for a while. So there's a mental health element to it.
Do your teammates also have creative outlets? Is everybody knitting or writing or doing something else outside of once they're done running?
Everyone in the village is actually doing tie-dye on the side and knitting. And no. Some do, you know. Some have their thing that they do on the side. I have a teammate who does, like, environmental, like, architecture, and she builds these amazing, like, flower pots that can be earrings and things like that. But some are at a loss for that, and I think there's an element of wanting that out of some athletes too. So not everybody, and some people thrive on not having anything else, and that's great too. If that's mm-hmm. what is best, that's great.
Yeah. And have you always been a creative person wanting to make things, and running was just part of that being creative, or how would you express the creativity and athleticism?
I think that once I found that running could be a collaborative thing and could be something that you could take on like a project, it reminded me of a play, or it reminded me of other things that I really enjoyed. So it just had to, I had to be enjoying it, mm-hmm. and I was eventually enjoying it.
So another great accomplishment is that Alexia is a filmmaker and actress in your own film. And it's called Track Town, and it premiered at the LA Film Festival, as Maureen said. And actually, when I first started watching it, I was telling her that I thought it was going to be a documentary about running. But it's a real full-on indie film. And to think that an Olympic athlete has also the time and interest and tenacity to make a feature film, it's quite remarkable. And let's play a short clip from it so you guys can get a sense of it. Can we play number 5, Popcorn?
Sweet, I know you're worried about tomorrow's race, but listen. Do you know what the kernels are?
What, Dad?
Untapped potential. Right? I have so many 10th graders, 11th graders on my team that could be great if they chose, but it's only 24 hours in a day.
Great.
You know what the burnt ones are? Burnouts. Overtrainers.
Okay.
Right? But this one, Plummy. You know what this one is? This is you, Plum. Perfect. Ready. Prime Kernel.
Tell us about this movie, Track Town. What inspired it? What is it about? And obviously you're playing a runner and a scene with your dad in the film.
Yeah, so Track Town is inspired by my experiences and observations as an elite runner. It's fictional, and the way it was born was I moved to Eugene, Oregon, where I now continue to live and train, and it was a place where people embraced the sport and knew about the sport in a way that other places embraced football or baseball. And I'd never been to a place where someone on the trail would recognize you and know that you had a race. And it felt like this bizarre and wonderful world. And my partner, who's my creative partner and the person I will marry, and he's in this room, Jeremy, who's here. He was at the time living in New York, and I remember calling him. He was finishing his first film, and I remember calling him and being like, there's this place where there are these people, and they all run all the time, and they also know how many laps a 5K is. And we decided that as filmmakers, we were interested in telling stories in these very specific worlds, and that this was the world we were in now, and that this was the time when I understood it most. And so we started developing Track Town as a feature film, and it also helped me get Jeremy to move to Eugene with me. And what we wanted to do with it was the runners in the film are all real runners, and I wanted to put someone on screen that looked and behaved in a way that was familiar to me, which I hadn't seen before. And so we had a ton of fun and learned a lot by making it.
And what do you mean you'd never seen anybody on screen that was like you? Like as a runner, as a woman runner?
Yeah, I think there have been running movies that star women, fewer than that star men, and that's fine. But I think just the experience of growing up really wanting something and being very driven and recognizing that not everybody feels the same way. Like that most of the movie is actually set in between races. And so it's the time when this girl is not allowed to run, where she's out of control and not, she's supposed to take a day off during her Olympic trials between the prelims and the finals. And there's this element of like losing a little bit of control that like athletes I can identify with. And I hadn't seen that sort of world put on screen in a way that didn't feel like a sports film, mm-hmm. felt like a story about people and relationships, but was set in this world where the stakes feel very high and feel familiar to me.
And how was it becoming an actress?
That was fun. It was during a month off running. We often will take like a time off running in between seasons. So we planned it so that I could really commit to the acting and directing with Jeremy. And what I found is we found this wonderful acting coach to work with, and she taught me how to warm up for acting the way I might warm up for running. Different, but like a thing I could do before stepping in front of the screen that allowed me to become plumb. And that was fun to see how you can warm up and be an actor like that.
What was the actor warm-up?
It was, for me, the technique that I enjoyed most is called sense memory, which Joni Darling, my acting coach, explained to me as, you know, if Plum is entering a situation where she's nervous, for example, she said, Joni told me, like, you don't need to conjure up the most nervous time in your life. You don't need to get super into that, but rather think of a time when you're nervous and some detail of it that has to do with a sense. So for me, the nervous thing, for example, would have been before indoor track races. I have these memories of like holding on to this metal railing around an indoor track. There's a railing often, and just holding it and feeling like really nervous for the race. And so before a scene, it would just be that the railing was in my hand, like behind my back for a minute or so before Jeremy would call the actors on stage. And that was enough to like get you in going into that place. It wasn't, and it's same with the race. Like you're not going to visualize the whole race over and over again. You're not going to warm up and run a 5K before the 5K. And so there's similar, like just warm up a little bit, you know, which is great.
Touching on some of the themes in Track Town and then you just being at the Olympics, what does it feel like being a female athlete, like today in this moment, now for you?
It feels great. it feels like a different sort of grown-up than I imagined when I was little. When I was little, I wanted to be a princess, and that's what I wanted to be. And that was I had a different image of what I might grow up and become, but I've loved what worlds and what people I've been able to meet by being an athlete and a female athlete. I think that the only difference is that, you know, I think some of my role models have specifically helped me to really embrace that I might have bigger guns than my then a boyfriend at a time. Not Jeremy, of course, but I think there is an element of like becoming proud of what a female athlete is, that and enjoying that, that I've enjoyed learning how to enjoy.
Do you feel supported by the culture and, you know, male athletes and just your surroundings of being fully confident as a female athlete? Or do you feel like female athletes still face different kinds of challenges than male athletes?
I think there are different challenges still. I think the dialogue is a lot more open now. Mm. For example, in this Olympics, the things that happened with Hope Solo, everyone seems to be talking about. And maybe 4 or 8 years ago, a female athlete may have been outspoken in a way that seemed uncharacteristic of a female athlete, and no one would have said anything. But I think now there's more of a dialogue, an open dialogue. And for me, it's always been important to just be what I hope that I could be. So, like, I try to be whatever I hope I will be, you know, rather than, like, there are problems, but I'd rather just continue moving towards the way that I hope it'll be, if that makes sense.
Just touching on this subject of female athlete, different, you know, kind of challenges, I wanted to play one more clip from Tracktown. Can we play number 4?
I can't recommend that you run in the finals unless you're recovered. You had an extremely aggressive race today, and your body needs to heal. I want you to take tomorrow completely off. No running.
But I never take days completely off.
The finals are in 3 days.
I'm well aware, but if you want to toe the line strong, you need to be smart now. Plum, what's your weekly mileage?
9,200.
It says here you haven't menstruated in 2 years. Is that right?
Is that bad?
It has to do with your bone density, which is likely low. And poor bone density can lead to complications. For starters, an increased likelihood of injury, permanent damage. There are long-term consequences that you need to consider beyond your athletics. I mean, you're still a woman.
What does that matter?
Now, when you're writing that scene, what was kind of inspiring you to kind of put this kind of scene in the film?
It's like a conversation that I've had with doctors and that teammates have had. So I think the one thing that's been interesting is like navigating like what is healthy for our bodies and wanting to be a really great athlete but not compromise our long-term health. And it's definitely something that like I wish I'd known more about before when I was younger, and I wish there was a more dialogue to share where you like learn about anemia before you're anemic and things that these are like the details, but these are things that we have to really think about when we're running 100 miles a week. So it was in the movie not so much to be like, this is a problem, because I think we are meant to run and that I'm doing something that is really in a responsible way, but more just to say that like these conversations exist and that they have to happen, or there are things we need to make sure we do to just be healthy people.
And is it something, are these topics, like you and your female teammates, like discuss? And when you say, I wish I knew more, is that because there's just not a forum for a way to find out about this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's better now. I think when I went to college, there wasn't like a rundown of like, you need to take vitamin D. There are certain, like, get your iron checked and things that we have to do. But now, you know, I've gathered all the information through teammates and some coaches, and we always share like what is the best calcium pill, or like when do you or basic things like calcium and iron block each other. So like if you're going to eat a steak, you can't have a glass of milk. I grew up having steak and milk at the same time, and now I can't ever do that, and that's fine. But it was great. It's been helpful to gather all these things, and I think that it would be very helpful for like a little guidebook of like practical things for training at this. Running this many miles.
I think you might have come up on a little project that you might do.
Yeah.
And you said that you talk to a lot of young girls, young athletes. What is it like when you're talking to them to be the kind of role model? You know, what are they looking for? What seems to resonate in your conversation with them?
I think the role model thing is really, you know, it is a privilege, it's a responsibility, it's really super fun, because when I was younger, I looked up to a lot of soccer players who were more vocal at that time, and I think what's so cool is that people just want to, like, connect with each other, mm-hmm. and the way I've been able to connect with some younger athletes is, like, so, like, those are my people, like, that really that matters so much, because that's a time, anytime as like anyone younger than me, I see as like a time when you're so fragile and you could become any number of things based on who you're able to imitate, really. And so connecting with a younger group of mostly girls is really special to me, and I'm very conscious about not sending out a tweet or something that says like just ran 20 miles, because that's not a thing they should imitate at any, unless they're ready for that, mm-hmm. but rather like just painted my nails crazy orange and like, or something that is, we can have in common that's more positive and connects us in a way that's like, can keep everything healthy and positive, I guess.
Is that because you see them grappling with, you know, kind of not positive issues or issues of self-esteem, or what do you see them grappling with?
I think, yeah, just wanting to be better. Like, everyone wants to be their best self. Mm. And so if they're seeing someone who's accomplished something that they want, it's easy to just try to do what you see they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a responsibility to make sure that what you're showing that you're doing is the things that you hope people will do, which I'm proud of, like, everything I'm doing, but, like, my program and my training was, like, a long process, and it's prescribed by my coach. It's very thoughtful, and so those things, I think, are very individual, whereas these things that we can share, like wearing your hair in a bun or these fun things, those are more energy related, and that is like, yes, let's like do that together.
So speaking of your hair in a bun, it's down tonight.
But it's my wig's on tonight.
Alexi is known, she's kind of a hair trend fashionista on the track. You're known for your bun and your scrunchie, and how did that all start? What was the origin of that?
The bun started in a practical sense. It was the most practical way to run a race. And I've worn it since I was little. I used to wear two when I played soccer, and it merged into one when I came of age. And and the trend of wearing the bun came to me from a young team that just tweeted a picture of the whole team wearing their hair in a bun, and I retweeted it, and the internet is very... it's like a very, it can just flourish like that. So it was a positive feedback loop after that. And again, it was something very simple and that we can all do.
And now they kind of look for your bun, like it's a thing, right?
I put duct tape in my hair at opening ceremony so that my yaya would see my bun, and she did.
Oh. Tell us a little bit about the writing process of making the film. I know you are in collaboration with Jeremy, mm-hmm. and you guys are life partners and creative partners. And just what is that process of, you know, creating like
It's fun to write for film because it does remind me of the poetry a bit, in that every word matters in a film. Dialogue is my sweet spot. It's what I like the most because it does remind me of that poetry discipline. Jeremy is really brilliant in thinking kind of big picture. We both write dialogue, we both think about the plot, but at its core, he's sort of the grew up playing video games and watching epic movies and can imagine like conflict coming from a mile away. And I want to, once they get into the diner, I want to talk to them, make them talk to each other. And so it's fun to work with him because I admire him in the things that he can do. And I think we have a mutual admiration for each other and a respect for each other's work and our own that makes for a good team.
And then do you guys take turns writing, or you go in your own corners and write, yeah, and then you collaborate, or how does it practically work?
Practically, we're not like both holding the same pencil or anything. but we go away, and like once we will come up with some sort of outline and go away and have certain responsibilities and come back and work through things together, go away, come back, I think.
And what was it like directing a bunch of non-actors who are mostly runners in mm-hmm. the film? Were they having a ball, or was it like...
The actors, you know, Jeremy pointed out something really great when we were filming, which was that they didn't respond super well to being like called actors or being told action and things like that. But when Jeremy was directing the race scene, he really started to talk to them like a coach. And to say, you know, all right, let's get on the line, ready, we're gonna, ready, set, go. Not action, but go. And then they responded. So I think it took some adapting and using the language they were familiar with to make them feel like they were, you know, capable.
Speaking of the race scene, let's play the race scene. Number 6. You're right. I mean, I've never seen a movie I can think of where a female athlete is portrayed in such a real way, you know? Like, instead of a super tough superhero or somebody who's, you know, like, flawed but almost not human. But I noticed it through the whole film. It was so vulnerable, it was so real, and I really want to acknowledge you for kind of sharing that story and being brave enough to make it.
Thank you. She's very capable and incapable in different ways.
No, I imagine that you must have pulled those kinds of stories and feelings from your community, right? Like your
yeah.
teammates. I mean, you're on the front lines, you're seeing it.
Yeah, and it was interesting working. We were in a Sundance Institute lab program with it, which is a really wonderful mentorship program. And for a lot of our mentors in the sort of beginning stages, it was hard to plumb the character. It was hard for some people to find as, could she exist? Like, could someone like this be so sheltered at this age? She's 21. And the truth is, like, yes, like, this girl is so real to me and to a lot of my teammates. And so it was fun to really tease out and try to bring a character to the screen who, we hadn't seen before. And yet some of us in this little world, like, know her so well.
You guys are going to have a chance to ask Alexi some questions, but before we get there, I wanted you to read one more of your poems and just tell us what you were thinking when you were writing this or before. It's called Belief.
Okay. Belief. The cake pretends to be a cake before it is baked, desiring the joining of a world of butter and sugar, milk, friends, flour, while powder resolves to batter by wanting place in the pan. Without lumps or complaint, it begs the heat, please, alter and whole the thick into shape, recognizably cake. By making itself believe, it is saying, I could be a cake. So that's like the fake it till you make it thing. Rewritten as a cake, of course.
you like cake.
So we had, anyway, it doesn't matter. So I think there's that element of like believing that something could be possible before it is, and writing down your goals, and that being the scariest part, and that, right, that you can will good things or will those things to happen by saying them or writing them down, and that's something that I've really believed, that I believed things could be possible before they were.
And where do you think that comes from you?
I think that the goals and that the activities that I'm choosing to pursue with like the film and the running are like hilariously not life or death. Like they don't, and maybe a lot of things that we do are not, we're going to be okay. You know, like I know that if I don't do this or that, it's not, it will feel like the end of the world, but it won't really be. And so I think having a sense of humor about that these goals are okay to want and treat like they're life or death, but that I recognize that there's a silliness element about them. I think that gives me more freedom to like chase those things, mm-hmm. because I feel like even if and when I fail, which like really does happen in along the way, that it's just a part of this thing that I'm choosing to have fun with.
Well, it's awesome to see you having so much fun and just being in the world, expressing all of your creative outlets. It's such a great model for anybody who has the inspiration or the idea to do something, that you're just out there, film, poetry, running, like you're just following your heart and doing, you know, what you should be doing in the world.
Thank you.
So I'd like to open it up for any questions. Does anybody have any questions?
Hi, Alexia. Thank you so much for coming and sharing. A lot of the items that you talk about, including in the film, it was a goal or a dream is a goal with a deadline, Napoleon Hill. And then you talk about visualization and how you're going to accomplish something. So have you read the book, Think and Grow Rich?
Nope.
Okay. Just curious.
Is that the end of your question?
No. Well, that wasn't the end of the question. The question was actually going to be which part of the book resonates the most with you, but since you haven't actually read the book, so I guess I will iterate the question slightly. Okay. With the visualization component or all of these items that you're doing each and every single day, how do you stay organized and productive of what you're going to do to stay on track?
Yeah, it's like the day-to-day is like so like routine that it's like, I feel like the image is like poetry and running, and it's like, nope, I wake up at a certain time and there's practice. I structure everything around the running schedule. So, I have a practice time and certain things that I have to be at that other people are meeting me on. So I think that comes first. And then after practice, in the mornings, Jeremy will work on our film stuff on his own while I'm at practice. And then we'll come together, have lunch, work. I'll take a nap. It's mandatory. It's called practice as well, which is important. And then we'll work a bit more, and I'll practice again a second run every day, most days. and then we'll have dinner, and then we'll work until we're tired. And that's what many days look like. And I think the discipline is the planning is important, and I think it's just important for me to know what I must do and what I can be flexible with. So a certain bedtime is like sort of a must because it's a part of the sport. And so I think that having a schedule really helps. Laying out my clothes the night before really, really helps. So making some of the decisions the night before, and I'm not like the most type A person, but then in some ways I am. Like, to lay out your clothes the night before takes out some little decisions of even like what color sports bra. It's like, just, I decided that on Tuesday is my gift to Wednesday. You know? things like that.
Next question? Yeah. Hi. Now that you have gone to Rio, and we'll be going to the next one, what countries have you competed in any type of track racing? And what country would you like to do it in the Olympics?
Travel to race? Well, I should say Tokyo, because that's 4 years from now. I am really excited for that if I am able to do that. Traveling to races is, it's fun. Like, there's an element of also like needing to not be on vacation until the race is over. But traveling is a big gift in the sport, certainly. So I'll say Tokyo for now. It's a good luck, me.
Thank you so much for sharing. I have a question. I noticed in the opening ceremonies commentary and in some of the pre-publicity that, like you, there are quite a number of athletes who reside in the United States, mm-hmm. train in the United States, and then choose to run for their country of origin. Mm-hmm. And I wondered for them, for you, what the experience is like. Well, two things. One is, do you feel a torn sense of loyalty at all? Mm-hmm. And also, I'm a triathlete, and I've cool. raced on Team USA in the amateur wow. division, awesome. Both in triathlon and duathlon. And there's a tremendous amount of excitement and positive energy that comes from wearing your team jacket and mm-hmm. being around the other and knowing who the other athletes are. And I wondered, how does that feel as an American? But for that time in Rio, you're identifying as a Greek.
Yeah, it was really cool, actually, because athletes make these decisions for any number of reasons. For me, it's always been super important to just know what my goals are and like what's the best and simplest way to get there. And with running for Greece, one of my goals is just to run at the highest level, and I could do that. I mean, I was 3 out of 4 people who are also American citizens in Rio, so like I think I am good enough to make the U.S. team. But also, one of my goals is to kind of reach a broad audience, like do something in the sport that hasn't been done. And what I saw some of my role models, Joan Benoit Samuelson, LA's queen of LA, you know, do years ago, I see myself doing now for younger Greek athletes who don't have a female role model. There's a lot of female distance running role models in the U.S., and I still consider myself one of them. But I think like the tentacles are spreading farther now, and that's really, really wonderful. And when you asked about what the experience was like in Rio, it was different. Like some of my teammates are on the U.S. team, so I saw them, spent time with them, but they also had their own training facility on the U.S. team. I don't think a lot of people know that. And I was at a track with every other country besides the U.S., so Bolt next to me on the track doing his workout, among others. And I thought it was so cool to be on the track with all the rest of the countries. And then in a practical way, I mentioned this to Sharon, but when I wore this jacket, Actually, nobody expected that I could speak English when I walked around the village. And so if I wanted to walk around anonymous and just really absorb what was going on, it was quite easy to do so. And so there was a fun element to that. And then the last thing is just the Greek flag was up next to the Olympic flag and the Brazilian flag because it's where the Olympics started. And I didn't realize, and entering the opening ceremonies first, I didn't realize like what it would mean. And it was so special because I was the first 10,000 meter runner ever in Greece, where distance running is born, to feel like I was both a part of a tradition and adding to it. So it was cool.
What did you feel when you, when someone pushed you?
Like in the race scene?
Yeah.
So in a real race this year, in the biggest race of my life before Rio, I really actually got pushed and I fell down and I was like covered in blood. And I remember what I felt was like, you know, when you spill a glass of milk and you like, without even thinking, you're like cleaning it up. Or any number, that's the most recent thing. I really did spill some milk recently, as silly as it sounds. But you just do what you need to do right then. So I just got up, and my instinct is always to finish the race. And so I just kept running. And in that race, I didn't finish as high as I wanted to because you lose some time and momentum. But I remember just consciously getting back on my feet, like in a physical way and in my mind, being like, okay, you're still in a race. You're still going to do this as best you can, given that your knee is covered in blood. And so there was that element of like, keep doing what you were doing, just with a new decoration on your leg.
I love the way that you used quotes throughout the film, be it from authors or artists or inspirational figures. Can you mention a little bit about who motivates you, where you find inspiration? Do you go to the same place or do you search the world for new inspiration depending on what your goal is?
Yeah, I love to like wake up and I love the brain pickings, which is Sharon's friend is in charge of that. And I like reading it and other things online that are kind of short but have words that just, like, get words going in my head. So it's not so much, like, reading an inspirational quote that will inspire me as just, like, thinking about anything, about bees or whatever, in a way that I, you know, described with words that I don't have in my, like, in my immediate Rolodex of words that I guess we all use like 14 words or something. So just something, anything that will like stimulate new words, I love. And so I love the brain pickings. I'll say that for this one.
Any other questions? Oh, one more down here. I think we'll wrap up with that.
This was wonderful. Thank you so much for coming. This is more of a question about your literary interests. I was really struck when I saw you on the PBS NewsHour about how engaging the poem you read was. And I was so struck because, you know, being an elite runner, it seems like that would take up all of your time. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to write a poem. How long have you been interested in poetry? Were your parents readers? I mean, how'd this happen?
My parents were readers, I think, but it was more in college that I found a mentor named Cynthia Huntington, who really, she was a professor and became my advisor. She's a poet and she's wonderful. And her name is Cynthia Huntington. And I adore her because she, for all reasons, but she helped me learn a pleasure in words and also taught me how to commit to poetry and things in the way that I might commit to a sport. So to really like sit with things with a poem or with words for a long time, which I don't feel like I can do as much anymore, to be like very honest. But in college, there was more time to like sit for 5 hours and not expect anything good to come out of my brain or my hand in the first hour at all. So I think it just taking it on as a discipline, like a learned practice, like athletics and creative stuff, I don't think we're just gifted. I think we can learn it, and that's where I'm coming from. That's like where my point of view is, I think, as an artist and an athlete.
And who is your favorite poet, or what poem was one of the first to really resonate for you? What was the first poem you memorized?
I don't have any poems memorized.
Okay.
I'm just being honest. But I in college, the first poets that I sort of attached myself to that I can remember were like Ron Padgett and Matea Harvey. I remember like really admiring Matea Harvey because one, she seemed like someone I would want to be friends with, but I also liked what she was writing. I think they're like the New York poets. Also, sometimes I feel stupid when I talk about poetry because I'm not like I couldn't name like 30. I couldn't name 30. But I like the poems that I like, and I like finding a book and just and opening it and reading the words.
Thank you.
Oh, there's one. We'll just wrap up. There's one more over here.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to ask about your relationship of the things that you can control in your life, like you set up the goal and do the routine to achieve it,
yeah.
And non-controllable things, like the mm-hmm. when the life just pushes you into another yeah. direction. How do you perceive the balance between them?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I think the visualization helps me, like, control what I can control, so, like, imagining what I think might be a painful moment, or going into a day that you think it's gonna rain, like bring a jacket, you know, like practical stuff, and that leaves room to have the willpower to handle the stuff you can't control. So when I step on a start line, I want to feel like I've done everything I can within my control. Like I love all random foods, but like I eat the same thing before every race. 48 hours out, like it's the same because I know it works. And I wear the uniform that I know, like in the way that I know works for me, the shoes, the hair, like I control the things that I can control. And that way when I'm on the start line, when I fall, that's the thing I can't control. I can handle it because I've already done everything else. Or if the weather is crazy, it's like I can't control that. Can't control my competitors. And I think also expecting that unexpected things are going to happen because they always do. So in Rio, after falling in Amsterdam, I thought about it. I was like, I could fall because it was now in my vocabulary. And it was almost a thing that I could control at that point because I'd already gone through it in a way that I couldn't. So that was really, it was helpful to like take the experiences that were really challenging before and turn them into as best I could something that I was more aware of or more familiar with. So that was, and I did. I like almost got tripped in Rio. Like a lot of people fell, and I was like, not falling this time. Like if I have to step on someone, I'm going to step on them because, I was not going to fall in Rio.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Alexia Baffert.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.